Hi, you are listening to the Defender Wellbeing Collective podcast, a space where you will learn about our shared journey, how the collective started, what we have learned along the way, and the important issue we explore together. I'm your host, Nanda, a feminist activist, storyteller, and the founder of Purple Feminist Crew from Myanmar. Welcome to our space, and thank you for listening. Welcome to DWC podcast on episode Financial Stability for Defenders. And we have the right persons to talk about this topic. So please, Wara and Salome, introduce about yourself to the listener. Let's start with Salome.
Hello, everyone. Happy to be here. My name is Salome Nduta. I am based in Kenya and I work for Women Human Rights Defenders Hub. This is a feminist organization that works to support women in all their diversities on matters safety and security, well-being, and of course, movement building. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Varadas. I am originally from Sri Lanka, but based in the UK now. I have been a lecturer and a researcher as well on issues around gender, conflict, LGBTIQ rights. I co-found an organization called Community Welfare and Development Fund in Sri Lanka that helps with precarious LGBTIQ individuals by providing them essential and necessary support. Thank you.
Thank you, both of you, for that lovely introduction. And let's start with the very favorite topic that I was waiting to talk with you guys. This is such a topic that is close to my heart, finance. We never talk about finance. In generally, in our society, talking about finance is such a taboo thing, especially around activists. You are supposed to give, and then never expect to receive anything in return. Even though you're burned out, exhausted, have a lot of health issue because of the work you do not and you cannot expect to get anything in return. So let's start with Wara. Wara, why do you think that when we are talking about wellness or activism, we often left out talking about well-being, financial well-being, or just well-being in general, you know? And because we don't talk about these topics, finance or well-being, what do you think are consequences you witnessed or experienced when this is not bring on the table?
I mean, talking about financial well-being among particularly civil society activists, you know, is largely shaped by the idea that comes with, you know, with this close association with neoliberal politics and policies. So the civil society sphere in the global south particularly is shaped by fundings coming from largely West. And then to complement whatever is being, you know, left out by the state in the global south. So this is a very neoliberal approach. So people who work in this field, of course, not necessarily, you know, aligned with neoliberal ideas, but still working on humanitarian social mobilization and human rights and social justice work, they are often being employed by the sectors that are really, you know, aligned with neoliberal policies, right? So when we talk about welfare of activists, or when we talk about well-being of activists, when we talk about, you know, anything related to financial stability of people who work in social justice work or human rights work, it is often shaped and also curated by the very principles of neoliberal ideas and individualism and those kind of things, which is exactly why there is a very weak discussion around how do we ensure, you know, these activists get some kind of sustainable pathway in their trajectory or life journey in the later stage of life. But it's always more focused on, you know, having one-off activities, one-off retreats, one of tools giving them, which is not the exact problem. The exact problem is rooted in the political and economic structure that activists are working in and working on. So, for example, let's say if I'm coming from Sri Lanka, I need to look at what are the welfare regimes that I can access as a person, first of all. You don't need to be an activist. You can be anyone. What are the options that I have when I'm retiring from my work or activism? And if I'm a woman, if I'm a queer person, right? And it's not just retreat. Of course, retreats and well-being things help. But I think it's more about talking about, political economic structures, which is not a very desirable conversation for neoliberal, civic spaces. So this is one of the reasons why I think the policies around financial well-being is very much individualized and not talked among in activist communities, or not even, created an ecosystem where they could talk about this. So I guess we need to, understand what is the structure, what is the ecosystem that we are being placed to work or carry on our social justice work. And this is shaped by that. So most of us, eventually, if you don't make your own living, you're completely sort of doomed towards the end of, latter part of your life. So this is very much the dilemma most of us faces.
So you touch upon a lot of things, and I want to ask Salome about your experience with financial journey. While creating and leading movement and justice work, what was your own financial journey looks like? Were there moments where it felt like a choice between care and survival? I know I felt many, many times like that, where I didn't have any money to survive for the month. But I still was doing social work because I could not do it, even though I was burning out financially, and I would be using my money out of my own pocket. There were several times that was like that in my early activist life. So what was your journey like, Salome?
Thank you, Nanda. What you explained is what most activists go through, because you see a problem, you have to intervene, and whether it requires money or not, what you prioritize is your intervention. And this is partly driven by the passion that activists have. And I wouldn't say I'm exceptional, because my journey was purely driven from a voluntary point of view. And what I was getting in return for my voluntary work was as little as $3 a month. But for me, that was not an issue, because I felt, one, people did appreciate what I was doing. And whether they equated it to $3, that was not my pushing point. My pushing point was the change. And therefore, if you come from a passionate point of view, which is what most activists are driven by, then you don't look at the amount. But one of the things I would wish to communicate to activists is, it is equally important for people to realize your worth and the amount of time you're putting into an initiative, and equate it at least a little bit higher. And you equally need to look at the cost of living of an activist in equal measure that you look at the cost of living of an expatriate. And for me, why the conversation of finance is important, and especially financial well-being, is because activists carry the weight of issues that you seek to champion. They are on a daily basis interacting with people who are directly affected. These people come with expectations on activists, and for them, they see an activist as someone who is well paid, who has a lot of money, while in reality, you do not have that kind of money. So one of the things that people need to appreciate is that an activist first and foremost have their own needs from their families, but they also come with needs that communities expect them to address. And therefore, financial wellness, from the point of view of an activist, should equally be addressed. And as someone progresses, for example, if an activist undergoes a training, it is important to appreciate that this person has built their capacity. And therefore, if you are giving them mobilization of $3, consider that they have built their capacity and make it $6. And as they continue building their capacity, as you continue giving them more role, appreciate the time they put in place. And therefore, at a personal level, I used to think of opportunities that were being given to me, and at times I wouldn't bargain for more money because I was contradicted. I will ask for more money and then I'm going to be denied an opportunity. But I think this is something that activists can use as a bargaining for the work they are putting in, but also bargaining for appreciation so that they can be treated equally as any other expert. So when we discuss financial well-being for activists, and if I may just add a little bit from the donor point of view, it is important that when funders give money for projects, can they consider that this activist, when they go on the street, they might be beaten, they might be arrested, and they do not have medical cover? How can that funding quickly be converted to address the health needs of this activist who is being paid poorly as a volunteer, who does not have a medical cover, and the cost of health in this world today is quite high? So, yes, we move from passion, but I think as the cost of living goes high, so should people consider the cost of living for activists.
Salome, thank you so much for touching upon a lot of things in your whole point of view, because I think it's really important. Now, as you were saying about, insurance and coverage and all, I've been an activist for over a decade now. I've never had an insurance for anything in my life. So that's something alarming to realize. And I really also like the point that you bring outside of the financial well-being, which is on getting paid with opportunity, such as training, retreat, workshop, travel, something like that. And I think that's also a way of saying that you're worth it. So I like the shift that you bring into the conversation. Wara, let's talk about the biggest gaps and myths activists believe about money. Like, you have been engaging with a lot of young activists and upcoming activists from your country and outside as well. So what do you think they believe about money, and what tools or shifts do you think are most urgent? I know that you have trained a lot of young people to have a backup plan, preparation, and having stability outside of your activist work. So walk us through that journey that you have been giving to the young people with examples and suggestions.
I think that's a very important question because when we talked about the agency of activists also in terms of defining what kind of well-being that world that they would envision and they want it to be, there are quite a few myths. Some, as Salome pointed out, we are expected to be, free labor in a way, passion-driven labor. Yeah, of course, we take it as a passion-driven labor, but not many activists realize they are in a system that treats them as just another worker. Because the donor's money, they look for value for money, best value for money. Where should I put this money so that I could deliver the most? The most question comes from a very neoliberal efficiency perspective that is very good for business-minded, but not for our field. But not many activists, tend to realize this reality, which is exactly why not many are ready to question about the, work agreement that they get as, consultants. This, sugar-coated name, completely packaged, full of precarity. You don't get sometimes paid for your welfare contributions by the projects, and when the project ends, there's no idea what you're going to do with what will happen to your job. There's no job security, and these kind of questions are seldom being questioned. Because activists also think in a way that, we are focusing on one problem and that's more important. But of course, you are equally important. We need you to be, alive. You need to you to be, strong enough to fight this battle. Otherwise, who would be there to fight? So this is one thing that we need to realize. As much as we pay attention, activists should also pay attention to their, long-term life plans. If you're not paying attention to your long-term life plans, you would definitely need another activist to help you. And we don't want to be in that situation. We're not in the business of forever activism, right? So the second thing I think most of the activists believe, once you're an activist, you're an activist forever, which I think, yes, of course. Once an activist is an activist for a lifetime. But that doesn't mean, you have to sacrifice your whole life for activism, right? You need to go back and look after yourself. You need to go back. You may have family responsibilities and care responsibilities. It's perfectly all right. Activists, focusing on their own life for some time and even forever. You can do your activism in your own way. So that's another thing. The question arises when, okay, I am being employed by this NGO and organization. I am being, trained here and there. I have been acknowledged in the retreats and other places. Everything is fine. Acknowledge. What if I quit this organization? What if I wanted to take a break for whatever reason, for medical reasons, for mental health reasons, right? Will I have a sustainable income to support me? Will I have a roof over my head, right? Will there be someone to look after me when I'm, not mobile, right? Will I still be able to support my elderly parents if I become unemployed, right? So, for example, I mean, these are some of the serious questions we need to ask. But when someone works for corporate sector, they would definitely look for what are the other benefits that they are getting, whether the employer pays for their, retirement benefits, whether they are getting a pension scheme, whether they are getting an insurance scheme. These are some of the serious things that, corporate sector, they would look at, even public sector, right? But do we have such kind of, consciousness when we take up a job in the civil society sector? I definitely encourage every activist, you definitely need to look for how much you're getting for your labor. It's not just something about, you're working for money. It's just about, there is a way to look after yourself. You're investing your time in this, right? And then whether the organization will look after you, as Salome said, if we are running into an emergency, let's say you're on the street, you get attacked. Right? Your house got burned down, right? Where would you go? Right? And these are some of the questions. I think these kind of questions, these kind of material questions, not just in the contemporary work, contemporary time that you're working, but in the later time of your life, right, have been completely, overlooked by the donor lobby. And we need to take the agency in doing that. So we need to remove, we need to burst our myths. We need to bargain. As Salome said, more agency is important for our people.
Yeah, you know what? I remember the conversation we had had like last few months ago about a long-term plan, like financial planning. And I was bombarded by that questions about that long-term plan. One of the sister have told me that every activist should have at least three different job, like a side hustle thing, so that you can pay for yourself even when your passion is not paying you. And I think that was such an important advice to give to young people as well. And Salome, when we are talking about wealth and money and scarcity, like what have you unlearned for yourself and for others to build a foundation, a stable foundation around finance, or financial well-being in general? It could be with your organization or it could be with your personal journey, anything that you have unlearned about money, or financial well-being that you would like to share.
I think One of the things I have had to unlearn is around scarcity. And for me, I always thought scarcity is permanent. But I've learned that this is not the case through my journey as an activist. And even now, when I'm running an organization, and when I talk about scarcity at an organizational level, I want to make reference to funding. When I started the Women Defenders Hub, there was not even a single cent by a funder, but we were able to give visibility to our work through social media. But most importantly, we trained people using the expertise we had, and we met them in their spaces. So we did not need money to hire a hall. We did not need money to pay a consultant. We became consultants because we had the knowledge and the expertise. And the community that we always assume without donor funding, they have no contribution. They contributed space, they contributed food. So I realized scarcity is not about lacking money in your pocket. There is scarcity in our minds. And when, as an activist, you strongly put in your mind that you need money to operate, then that is an area that we seriously need to address as activists, because we can bring change using the knowledge that we have, using our creativity. And as you rightfully put it, the side hustles, most of those side hustles are things that you do with your hand. I was challenged last week by my board chair, who is a lawyer by profession, employed a very good job, but when USAID funding happened, her job was not able to pay her as she was being paid. Because she has not practiced law for a long time, she could not directly jump into legal practice. But currently, she is knitting, she is making soap, and she is baking. And these are the side hustles that have been giving her money for the last 2 months. And when I spoke to her, I realized how scarce I was in terms of using my hands. And I'm actually now turning that around because I know I have strength. I know with internet, you can go online and learn to do something. So scarcity is about the mentality that we put in our minds, and we need to change that. I think for me, the second thing that I have had to unlearn is how to use my freedom of choice and time. And when you are employed, you tend again to close your mind to what the rules of your place of work dictate, the demands that are put on you. You're clearly told you have to work between 8 and 5, but you report to work at 7, and you are not able to reclaim your 1 hour. You're seated on your laptop even at lunchtime. You're not able to reclaim that 1 hour. At times, you have to work over the weekend. And when you work over the weekend, your organization is not going to pay you for that time. So, what I have learned is that I can make my choices and I have the freedom. And those extra hours that I have been putting into the organization, I have shifted them to think about my wellness, including looking for opportunities that I can do extra job as a consultant and create resources for myself, which goes to beef up the salary that I am getting at the organization. Because as you get older, as your kids grow, The demands on you are so much that if you do not make extra coin, if you do not create time to be with your family, you are likely to lose them along the way. So I am exercising my freedoms and utilizing my time well, something that I have had to unlearn over time. And I think the third thing I want to share is that you should never be shameful when you do not have something. I grew up from a very humble background. I found myself in spaces where I was interacting with the who is who. And I was always ashamed of saying, I am from this background. We call them informal settlements in Kenya. So when you're, and informal settlements are mud houses. So when you get into a space where someone is living in a mansion, you are ashamed to say where you come from. But then I realized something, that I brought on the table knowledge and experiences that these people did not have and they will never have because they will not move from their mansions and live in the informal settlements. And when I overcame that shame, I was able to demand and request at the same time for people to appreciate what I was bringing on the table. So, for activists, when you do not have food, don't feel ashamed to say, yesterday I did not eat anything. Because no one is going to give you until you present your case. So, there is nothing shameful about lacking, including having no bus fare. If someone has invited you to attend a training or a meeting, be open and tell them, I really want to come and I require to be in that space, but I do not have bus fare. Or for me to come and I close my small business where I make money, I need to carry something back home. And for me, those three, I have unlearned them and I am training the women I'm working with because it is only in talking about who you are and the needs you have that people will start planning accordingly. Otherwise, if you do not present your case, people continue planning as per the requirements of a donor, as per the requirements of the organization, the results they want to achieve. And some of those things do not speak to the needs of activists.
You put it so beautifully about removing shame. And speaking of which, I want to bring back to this shame and guilt conversation to Wara. How are you teaching or how are you practicing and building and how do you want to suggest activists beginning like to building financial sustainable financial practice without shame or even with limited income that, such as budgeting, saving, planning? Like, do you have any practical starting points for young activists to learn from or anything you have learned for yourself that you would like to share might be really useful for the listeners here?
Very well, thank you. I think for any young activist, I've learned a few things that I'm going to share. First thing, do tell yourself repeatedly, working in the civil society sector is the most precarious job that you're going to have it. If the funding vanishes, you're out of the league. So remember, you need to be on a constant run, on constant look for funding to finance your job. And this is the most one of the precarious jobs sugar-coated. In the name of, oh, you are a civil society worker, activist, or consultant, whatnot, right? So if you think this is not sustainable for you, move on to new ones. So there's no shame in that, right? Second thing is that the problem is not just something that lies with you. The problem is larger. So remember that. So the problem is, look at the country's welfare policies. If you come from a country that doesn't give you free healthcare, I mean, you would have to set aside some amount of money from the very beginning, which is not even guarantee you that will get you the most premium, optimum treatment that you would need when you need it, right? So the problem is not just one person's problem when we think about financial well-being of activists. It's a larger problem of neoliberal policies are being promoted, larger problem of being part of an ecosystem that is predominantly neoliberal origin, civil society. And therefore, it's extremely imperative that we extend our solidarity from the beginning, that social justice, sustainable framework struggles. So, for example, struggles for free education, struggles for free healthcare, struggles for, elderly protection, struggles for, disability protections. These are some of the social justice movements that takes place around the world. So extending our solidarity from the very young age would bring longer term changes. So that's the second. Third thing is, as Salome very rightly put it, I think we need to be not shameful about when we prioritize our individual and own needs and our life goals. So, for example, I'm going to tell you this, people move away from one place to another because they find that one place is no longer prudent for their, survival. So they move to a new place, right? They move countries. I have seen, how activists are being shamed for leaving their own country and trying to, find refuge in other places. I mean, this is a complete neoliberal and xenophobic rhetoric. We shouldn't judge our people like that. If you think you have worked for some time and you think it's time that I need to move on to a different place, you're very well within your right, and you don't be shameful about it, right? You need to look after it because when you're old, if you happen to live in a system that doesn't look after their elderly people, you are completely in deep trouble. You don't want to be a burden to another person. So remember that. Of course, it's important that we do our part to the community, but it's equally important that we plan our future, even if it is look very bleak and you don't see any future in that, you keep that. So the practical tips, I think. Maybe I'm not very much useful in terms of giving practical tips, but I think I'm more useful, I guess, in terms of motivating young people to think differently and act differently. And the practical tips could include, you save mandatory savings, and then, have a budgeting system. I mean, this will be helpful, but it's not going to solve the larger problem because it's not the problem just within you. It's not that you're getting a lot of money, you don't know how to spend it. So the diagnosing the problem is extremely important when you plan out your future. So for example, like even we have different layers of activists, right? So there are activists who get really well paid. And if they are not saving anything for them, I would suggest, okay, you need to have proper budgetary tools. But we also have a larger pool of ground workers, grassroots activists who doesn't get paid for months and months. I can't go and tell them you need to do budgeting properly. For them, I think the problem is not about budgeting, problem is about resource distribution. So the donors needs to, reflect on how they distribute resources, from which layers. Right, which part of the country, which part of the world, and then you need to also look at what are the support systems that exist within your own community, which you need to nourish if you want to reap some benefits or part of the benefit system. So, for example, if you have a community support program, make sure you contribute to that, make sure you're part of it. If you have a free clinic, health clinic, make sure you put some of your time to ensure that is sustainable because then when you need it, you can go there. This is the same case with government systems. So I have seen some of the, neoliberal NGO work that promotes privatization of healthcare. This is a disaster. If you don't have money, you won't get those healthcare. So you really need to think about, on which side of the struggle that you wanted to invest your time as well. So if you have that clarity from the beginning, reflection from the beginning, you would eventually land into a journey that you don't have to struggle a lot.
I appreciate you being realistic about giving the suggestion. And I remember when we were having conversation about this financial aspect of our life, we talked about, and you said something about if we don't sustainable life or sustainable financial plan, how are we going to be able to help other if we are not helping ourselves? And that was also a remarkable, I think, word from you that if if we don't help ourselves properly, it's kind of we are burning ourselves to keep other people warm. So it's very important that we reevaluate our life choices or career choices. I know a lot of activists who grew up very resentful. They think that they are not appreciated. Like Salome said, sometimes appreciation or compensation is not just really about money. It's about acknowledgement and, opportunities, that sort of thing. And there are so many people around, like, the older generation activists, I've seen that they are so resentful to civil society because they think that they have helped so much and they are not getting any appreciation, any compensation, and their life is now broke and they don't have any money, they don't have any health, and they don't have any appreciation, and they just resent all this society in general because they are not appreciated. So Salome, let's continue what Wara said. What practices, emotional, spiritual, logistical, have helped you feel more grounded in your financial life? Like, what would you say to someone who feels overwhelmed by money? It could be your younger self, or it could be someone you know right now. Like, what kind of suggestion would you give about money? Because money is so taboo. I don't know in Kenya and Sri Lanka. In Myanmar, you never talk about your money. But then people just so impolitely would ask you in the face. The only question about money you can ask in the society is how much do you earn, huh? That sort of question. That's it. The rest you cannot talk about at all. So, Salome.
I think picking from Wara's contribution, planning for your future is important. And as an activist, you need to ask yourself, where do I want to be tomorrow? It's our future is as early as tomorrow, because when I go out today, I might come back safe and sound, or I might not come back. And that means you have to plan for every minute. So when it comes to finances, you know that you are in this space where funding is controlled by donors, and you are a volunteer, so there are certain things you do not enjoy, like health. So first and foremost, you have to ensure that my health is paramount. So even when I go on the streets, I can't afford to be beaten. And if I must be beaten, then I have to make sure it is not severe beating. So you are on the street, on demonstrations, but you're very careful when you see an officer trying to hit you, because you know you don't have a medical cover. So you plan what do I need? How much do I have? And what do I need in terms of extra, and where can I get it? And when you ask the where, then that means you need to create relations that will help you meet your gaps. So if you're not a member of a group, in Kenya we call them merry-go-rounds, you start saving merry-go-round, meaning we put money, today we give Wara, tomorrow we give Nanda. Next month it is Salome. And that way, then you're saving for a rainy day. And we put as little as Kenya shillings 10, but you're putting it on a daily basis, because you know by next month I will have my 30 shillings and 30 shillings from all the members, and I can do something substantive. So you plan and you start saving. The other thing is to appreciate the little that you make, but also don't use all of it. For example, I shared my experience where I started with $3 a month. When I progressed to getting $11, I did not change my lifestyle. I decided, now that I have gotten 11 and I was able to survive on three, I will spend four at least to show some improvement in the earnings I'm making, but I will save. And that is something that we need to inculcate as activists, that every time you make a little more, as you decide to say thank you to yourself, don't say thank you with everything. Put on the side some little money, because you never know. As Wara said, this is one of those jobs that you have no assurance of what will happen after the project. And because you know your project is a 2-year project, why don't you start planning for the after the 2 years before another project comes on board? So appreciating and taking time to put aside a little more. Then the third thing that I practice, which is to deal with my emotions, again, not to end up in hospital, is to join spaces and practices that will take care of my wellness. So we have groups where we meet on a monthly basis to do nothing else other than share a meal, play cards, and that way we also catch up. And I have seen this group slowly moving towards sharing opportunities of employment, of consultancies, of trainings, so that it is a space where you're debriefing, but you are also getting nourished in terms of knowledge and opportunities that you can utilize out there. Importantly for me, practicing gratitude. When you give me something, I do for you. I will, once I finish, I will tell you thank you and remind you that should another opportunity arise that I can do, please give me. But also, if you need someone who can do this, this, and this, I have someone that I can recommend. And these are practices that I think if we as activists embrace, we will not just be thinking about ourselves. We will be thinking about our colleagues. We will be thinking about that future that we do not know, but which we are very clear that without donor funding or an organization supporting us, we will not have resources.
Yeah, you know what you just said about a tribe? I like what you said about hanging out with a group of friends, just not doing anything, just healing each other just by being near each other. It's such a good investment because I remember with DWC as well, we became a community. And specific example with Wara is that we quickly connected and we sort of stay in touch. And then when an opportunity came up, Wara contacted me saying that, "Hey friend, let's do this together." And then we did it together and we were at a conference together, and that friendship just grow and grow. And we are not just activists to each other, we are friends, you know. And we became partners together in a conference, outside of conference. And I think that's such a beautiful investment in a community, having a tribe. And you just pinpointed in a most beautifully, authentically as possible. I appreciate you for that. And with DWC, I want to talk to you guys that we were there together. We met in Nepal together and we talked about well-being in every aspect possible for defenders. And with that experience, as well as on your own journey as activist and queer activist, feminist, how can we reshape our collective narrative around money in activist community from what Salome said earlier, scarcity and burnout to sustainability and sufficiency. And I would also add self-efficacy. I think self-efficacy is so important and so rarely taught to activists, you know? So what role does collective care or mutual aid play in that transformation? Like, for example, DWC help us have these conversation during our cohort, but as well as with these podcasts, we are going to help a lot of other listener to rethink about their financial well-being in different ways and asks very important question both Wara and Salome propose during this conversation. So let's talk about that, the collective care.
I guess I think that one of the good things that I've learned, I mean, I'm reminded of by being part of DWC, the meeting, is that they don't take our labor for granted. And everyone was very careful about, our presence, our time, and that is being acknowledged and appreciated. And not just that, I think everyone was standing up for it. I think that's an important thing as activists. We know we are in a struggle to secure funding, do things and everything. But at the same time, we as a collective community, wherever we are, we have a responsibility to stand up for each other's well-being. So that means, demand acknowledgement where it is lacking, point it out, where if you see a, if you are being taken for granted, stand against it. And you stand for each other is an important element of, ensuring there is a nourishing environment for collective care. First thing. And the second thing, I also felt this is quite important that we need to be more reflective as a community, not just in terms of to ask the question, are we doing enough? It's not the, I mean, it's not just that question. The question is around, what have you got other than this civil society? We need to ask the question of, what do we have that things that we have overlooked other than our civil society ecosystem that could actually help us, our financial well-being or collective care in the long run? And asking that question will actually point out a wider direction in terms of where we could, put in some of our actions, where we could also, seek out some support, right? So where I come from, when we talk about collective care, healing, being part of a community, meeting friends is extremely important. But at the same time, when you're not well, you need to have a system that look after you, right? And if an activist get ill, you don't really need to go after your donor, to access their resources. If you have a system, or like if you have a public hospital that provides you better treatment, you could just simply take them to there, and then another activist come and help to take them there. And same way goes with, if you have kids, imagine like, why do we have to do more than one job to feed our kids? Why do we have to do more than one job to pay our kids' school fees? Why do we have to do more than one jobs to, save some money for our, later stage of life when we actually make money? When we actually pay our taxes, do we not deserve a time for ourselves after work? What are we aspiring? Are we supposed to be machines, even in civil society? So I think it, of course, self-efficacy is important. We need to be more efficient, but I think we need to be more efficient, not just in terms of, exhausting our time and resources, but in terms of tapping into other potential resources without compromising our work-life balance, right? So I guess, some of the countries, there are countries in the world that provide you free healthcare. Of course, it's not free, it's supported by your tax money, right? And some countries, they don't provide you free healthcare because the tax money is being spent on wars and fighting, wars and, all the other things. So these are some of the larger questions also we need to ask when we, if you are to ensure collective care, resources is key. That can be money, that can be individuals, that can be a supportive system, emotional support, an ecosystem. This all comes into resources. But I think that resource is not necessarily confined to civil society sector. There is state sector, there's private sector, there is, whole lot of, there's family. So we need to look into broader circles to, as a team, we need to encourage them to look into borders. So if somebody come to me and tell me like, you just bargain your consultancy fee much better with the donor, I said, yes, I would definitely do that, but it will not alone help me, right? I need to go and stand up with people who fight for, free education or free healthcare so that my child will get a reasonable affordable education, good education, right? Not everyone is able to make the money that I do make. So these are some of the things that I would, we need to be more aware about the limits of civil society activism that can help us in collective care, but also we need to be educating ourselves to get to know what's out there other than this.
No, the suggestion you are giving is so interceptive. Salome, do you want to add anything more that you want to suggest to the listeners?
Listening to Wara ask, why do we have to do two jobs? That helps us acknowledge that our scarcity or lack of finances is systemic. And that means we need to do something as a collective. Because even if we set aside time for wellness, we set aside money for wellness, if we do not address the root cause, we will continue setting aside money, initiating projects. So, as a collective, we need to start thinking about how do we address the real issues that are affecting activists. I think the other thing we can do at DWC is to constantly remind activists that burnout is not a badge of honor, and that people need to deliberately step aside and critically ask themselves, what am I doing? And how is it affecting me at a personal level? Because most of the time we think about institutions and the projects, and we are running around ensuring that we please other people, our bosses, our donors, and we never take time to please ourselves. So DWC should take it upon themselves, and here I'm talking about us, that every time you come across that kind of defender, remind them that burnout is not a badge of honor. The other thing is the interdependence that we have with each other. As members of DWC, as activists, let's remember that your struggle, in a way, ties to my struggle, and I shouldn't watch you struggling when I can do something, because it will be just a matter of time before I experience the same. And because I did not offer you support, it will be your turn to look at me as I struggle. So I think it is important as a collective, we get to reach out to each other, know what are we doing in our various contexts, how is this affecting us, and just seeking for support and solidarity from each other. And we shouldn't wait for someone to ask. If you get to, because I know we interacted, and the 1 week and some days we were together, you could actually feel someone when something is affecting them, because they would be tearing, their voice would be trembling, they would just shut off. So if I'm talking to you and I'm hearing your voice trembling, I don't need to be told there's something wrong. And regular check-ins as DWC members would enable us to know who is having an issue, who has graduated to what level, and we celebrate each other. But I think the other thing that I loved about our team is the different capacities that we had of healers who are using indigenous knowledge, indigenous materials, resources that we can tap into as peers, but also open it up to other activists. We had people who had special oils that we could use. Those oils are not available in Kenya. They are very expensive. But if we can have a DWC member who uses oils, just doing a session that will benefit other activists in other countries, because we were very few, we need to open those resources to be enjoyed by other activists. So collectively, we have knowledge, we have expertise, we know each other. It's just extending that knowledge, expertise, the grace to reach out to many more activists, and DWC can help us do that.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And I love that. I think when we were together in Nepal, it was so meaningful in so many ways. We not only developed, there was a development in our friendship and about each other's situation, but also there was a development in understanding the whole well-being on the next level, because we were in person, everything was visually visible, you know, like Salome said earlier. So I truly appreciate all the suggestion and all the discussion that you two brought into this conversation. Thank you, Salome. Thank you, Wara, for being part of the DWC podcast. And precisely because of that reason, we are creating this podcast to share resources to the people that were not part of the DWC cohort to have access to some of the discussion that we had had during our cohort period, you know. So this podcast would be publicly available for everyone who wants to listen through the DWC website. So I'm really excited, and I appreciate both of you bringing such a meaningful and insightful conversation, a very difficult and taboo topic around finance and money and, you know, being an activist, all that. So thank you so much for being here, both of you. Thank you for joining us on the Defenders Wellbeing Collective podcast as we shared with you bits and pieces of our solidarity journey. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please share it with your fellow activists. This space reminds us that even in resistance, we deserve rest. Until next time, take care of yourself and one another.